a small flat. That's going to be small as fuck.
Let me see if I can. I'm just going to keep dumping. Fucking hell.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. This time hosted by two people who are currently broadcasting from the United Kingdom, as you can tell by the excellent broadband provision in Greater London for Usurper. To be honest, it's almost like if you were in like prison, would it probably be better actually?
Seriously,
are you in prison? Did they get you at the border? Were you trying to bring in cigars or something? And they were just like,
I have seen ISIS videos with better production quality than what I'm producing right now. Yes, that's true. I am on Her Majesty's Wi-Fi. Her Majesty's Wi-Fi is garbage.
Well, I mean, it would be. I mean, Her Majesty is currently presumably at an advanced state of decomposition.
Oh, that's wrong.
Oh yeah.
So how was Duckworld? I gather you that it was your first tourist stop in the UK was to go to Duckworld, right?
We did go to Duckworld. That was exciting. My son is a big duck fan, so he does have a ton of things. So we did have to make a stop over there. But yeah, no, we got in this morning, you know, overnight flight and just kind of dragging through it. And two younger kids, so we're just forcing culture down their throats. And we'll regroup tomorrow.
I see your son's picked up a Duckworld hoodie. Did you just like go straight to the merch tent?
No, that one actually we brought from home. That's how bad that is. So we were adding on to the Duckworld items of it. And I did get those kick-ass glasses, which I don't see.
So he's a legit fan of ducks.
Yeah, a duck enjoyer.
Which is,
wait, there's more than one Duckworld? I think this is an international thing.
I guess so. Yeah, it's not a big store. It's just a small store, but there's a, you know, I mean, a ton in there.
For that part of London, that store, the ground rent on that store is probably $200,000 a year. So it's a big store. They got to make their duck bucks like off of a lot of passing people who are into ducks, I suppose. I mean, I have to admit, I just saw where you were based and I screenshotted Duckworld, put a ring around it, and was like, that's pretty funny. Sent it with the message, big duck energy, I believe, was my message. And the next thing I know is I get a message back saying, oh, yeah,
we're already there.
A lot of interest in ducks here. We're already there. We've already got the duck worlds. Yeah. It's great. And I'm like, well, the joke's on me. I thought I was being funny. And it turns out not only is Duck World actually like a thing, but also it's an international franchise for duck enthusiasts. Of it which is. Apparently there are a lot of duck enthusiasts beyond just
it was packed. You know,
my son.
Yeah, it was packed.
was that also the reason for StreamYard? Because of the duck logo?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, look, yeah, at that. There's a duck.
There is a duck up there.
I'm kind of used to the fact that I have a toddler and he just calls every single bird a duck. You know, sparrow, duck, swan, duck, swift, duck.
Not even bird. It's just duck, huh?
Just no, everything with four legs is a dog. Everything with two legs and wings is a duck. It's an easy, elegant system, some would say. You know, take that, zoologists. Big zoology telling you what to call these things. You just need like one or two words, really. It's like that. Is it XKCD where they did that book where they were only allowed to use like 100 words to explain everything, like to explain like a Saturn V rocket using only, I think it was the 100 most used words in Google searches or something like that. So they have like the Saturn V rocket and they have the label of what it is. And it says like Upgoer 5. And then like at the bottom, it has like a line, you know, an arrow going up to the thrusters. And it has something like hot, come out, make, go up. And you're like, yes. This is finally a science book at my level, at the level of your average validator of the Cosmos ecosystem. Amazing stuff.
It's like the validator node 101 child's book or whatnot.
Sure. I mean, to be honest, like more documentation should be written in the style of whatever that book was called, the XKCD one that had an Upgoer 5 in it. I mean, yeah, that might be a double-edged sword, but what could possibly go wrong? Let's get five-year-olds validating... Validating shit coins. Let's go. Let's fucking go. It's going to bring the next billion in. They're all going to be under five. Anyway, Manny, welcome to the podcast. How's it going, man?
So, well, let's introduce Manny first. So for those who don't know, Manny is with
Verigen. That's not how you do this. You can't possibly talk to the guest. That's like, we're going to have to go back and then introduce them and blah. We're trying to make it organic now. Come on.
Manny's so fucking jarred that someone's talked to him. He's just like, shit. I don't know. So anyway, Manny's from Verigen. He's like a dev. So welcome. Welcome, Manny. So a few of the squad here on the Verigen testnet. It's been fun and interesting. And I'm sure we'll organically ask you some questions as time goes by about what the fuck is going on over there. Do you want to say a few things? You want to get some shit off your chest? I DM'd you, by the way.
The only thing I'm about to say is that Manny, lead DevRel engineer at Verigen, used to be at Polygon for a year, more supposed for the European region. Used to be a lead DevRel for Anchor as well. I'm sure you know them in terms of an RPC provider. And then I also used to be a tech lead for another 500 person web agency based in the US where we actually revamped Coindesk.com. So been in tech for a little while, but that's a bit about me. My day to day is really interacting with you guys on like Discord as well as other like protocols and trying to get you guys all talking to each other and getting integrated in terms of Verigen. So yeah, that's about me.
Fielding out complaints.
Yeah. I've done calls with some of you guys as well. Like, just to be able to kind of get a sense so that you guys aren't like shitting on the chain publicly on the Discord. So I just like take it offline. That's basically what I'm trying to do. It's like,
man, how did you get involved in Verigen? Like, how'd you even find out about early and all that kind of good stuff?
The way I actually found out about Verigen was about a year ago in Paris. So I had just left Polygon, attended ECC. I was like just with a friend of mine. We were going to different events. And funny enough, there's actually in the DevRel space, there's actually a Telegram group that just is only DevRels in crypto. There's like 340 of us now, whatever, in this group. And Verigen at one point actually posted some job boards for DevRels. And we were just talking about it because it was kind of ridiculous. The salaries were 100,000 to 1 million, right? As the salary ranges. And we're just like, like, what's going on? I'm like, okay, interesting. A company that is coming out of Canada. Didn't think too much about it. And went to ECC, saw our CTO, Dev Bear. This is basically a guy who's like in a bear mask talking about the infrastructure in terms of Polaris at the time, their V1. I ended up attending one of their events, which I was kind of blown, like just took me off guard. I went to the event and they're like, you know, you go to a typical event and you're like, oh, okay, it's only these particular beers or this drinks, et cetera, that you can only, and they're like, whatever you want, like, doesn't matter. It could be like the craziest drink you want. And I was like, okay, interesting. These guys have like money. And then they were like, okay, we got to stop the networking. Everybody needs to sit down because we're going to have duck confit to eat for dinner. And I was like, where am I right now? This is like really weird. And funny enough, I just like was like started reading some of their stuff. And then one of the recruiters that ended up reaching out because I was just, I'm that good on socials. And we just started talking back and forth. And then it led to me coming on the team, essentially. It's going to be like a year in October or so.
They always get you with a duck confit, right? That's the first thing. As soon as that stuff comes out, you're like, all right, where do I sign? I'm in.
By the way, like completely unrelated to your whole duck story as well.
Ducks are just popping up everywhere around it.
Yeah. Leave the ducks out of this, man. Come on. What do the ducks ever do to you?
So at risk of acknowledging a guest and talking to them, I did want to just, some things I guess might be nice to talk about here, seeing as though people show up week after week just to listen to us talk about, technical things on blockchains. So the V1 of the Verigen testnet was quite like, I don't want to say difficult to run, but there were like some issues in there where there was quite a bit of state bloat and a lot of, people miss blocks a lot. It was hard to sort of resync a node and that type of stuff just because of the size of the snapshots and everything. And from that, Bearchain decided to like take a different architectural approach for the chain in the V2 testnet and separate out the execution layer and the consensus layer more like a Ethereum type network. And I mean, it seems to be running quite a bit better. I just thought I wanted to ask, like, what was the, besides the issues with testnet V1, like, were there any other motivations for separating those out, like efficiencies that created? Or
I think the motivation is to make sure the chain is working, right? Chain working, step one. Ultimately, I think what, and I won't do it justice because like Dev Bear, CTO, kind of wrote a podcast, wrote an article on this on our blog and whatnot, on the architectural change. But there was a big bet on precompiles, basically, which is kind of interesting. Like the whole bet was like precompiles are very, very efficient in terms of, just being able to execute specific things. You could like almost precompiles for ERC-20 tokens. It could just handle transactions much more efficiently, right? And the thing that we found was one of the issues was that just Cosmos couldn't handle the transactions just as well as, you know, as ETH does or not. So there was a lot of P2P storms that we noticed kind of come up and would just like lock the network at different times, right? And the idea with the precompiles, it was really almost like this single binary that was like a wrapper where it was like you had Cosmos SDK wrapping around the EVM, handling some of the transactions, and then being able to interpret it for some of the bytecode for on the precompiles. The issue was like we noticed right away is that some libraries, and we kind of said we're using like Foundry or Hardhat or etc., where we're trying to do basic like transfers, we'd notice that the bytecodes actually just wouldn't work like correct, like exactly, and we get specific errors, right? On top of this whole like issue in terms of just this incompatibility and P2P storms or whatnot. And the funny thing is that the CTO had been thinking about this for a little while in terms of like, hey, like I think precompiles are great, but they're great for a specific use case. I think my bet on them was, and I'm not, don't quote me on this, but his idea was like, hey, there, it was great, but at the same time, I think it's great for a particular use case. And I think we have actually a few different protocols that actually took Polaris, and like we've since archived it, but people are still using it for application specific chains. And this is like a really, really like ideal use case where you're doing specific transactions that you're understanding exactly what you're optimizing for. So precompiles as a framework was for Polaris was really, really ideal. And then what I think what Dev noticed, was that, you know, there's this incompatibility of, you know, it's not one for one when it comes to the execution client, right? You know, what does that look like in terms of, you know, making sure that it's fully compatible? Because one of the things that we kind of see for a lot of these different like L2s or L1s is like there's constant forks and people are like, you know, if you look now like at Linea or Polygon ZKVM or et cetera, they're all like specific forks that are like potentially at London or Shanghai or at specific forks. And then they always have to figure out ways to backtrack in terms of adding new features when it comes to new upgrades. And we just didn't want to deal with that because like that requires so much money. We're not going to become Optimism. You know, they have tons of money to be able to just maintain that set, right? And the thought was like, where can we really optimize things? Like everybody, all developers like really just want is EVM, like not to like shame Solana in that sense, but everybody just wants EVM. It's just like, it's a lot easier for them to understand. So let's just take the best case of like that existing ecosystem of existing execution clients, like Gethreth, et cetera. And let's focus on the consensus side of things and really kind of separate concerns just like ETH did to make it more modular. And this is where, you know, it introduced so many new things where it's based off of Comet BFT. So actually it's achieving single slot finality. So I'm telling you guys, because you guys know this already, right? But at the same time, it really kind of optimized things. And we got down to 2 second block times, which is crazy. And then still being able to kind of support that whole EVM ecosystem from that point of view, right? But the bet is really that modular aspect versus this monolithic bet with Polaris and now with Beacon Kit that really, really achieves that. And it's just, if you haven't seen the talk, Dev did a talk at Modular Summit just at ECC. So I definitely recommend checking it out. It goes over the entire, you know, the reasoning behind things, what is also possible, and he'll do it much better justice than me. But as far as it goes, it's I'm really bullish on this because for me, I think it's a framework not only for L1s or L2s, it has the potential to become, you know, the equivalent of its CDK or OP stack, where people can start building on top of it as well, which I think is a really, really interesting bet.
Manny, do you know why did you guys continue with Comet on the consensus layer? Like, why not just, you know, I mean, there's a lot of work in BeaconKit. We were taking a look at what was going on in there. And I think, obviously, you said you were at Polygon too, right? So there's some history there with kind of the Heimdall Bohr type structure and kind of using Tendermint or, you know, Comet Tendermint as a basis for consensus. But why did you guys, what do you know the was it more like, hey, we've already had this, you know, from Polaris, we already had this kind of infrastructure here. We understand it very well. So we want to continue that forward. Or was there something like really that you guys wanted to continue with when it came to comment on from BeaconKit?
So I think two answers. And I don't know Dev's mind in terms of all this, just to speak on his behalf. But I think two things. One is, there is that familiarity. Like Dev is actually really, really, if you look at some of his history, he was actually really, really active in terms of the Cosmos SDK. He still kind of contributes to it. He talks to a lot of also on the ETH execution side of things in terms of their team and works with them as well. So him contributing, a lot of people actually know him from that perspective. And I think there was the bet that, you know, if we're that Comet BFT in that sense, it achieves, there's this, I forget what the triangle is, like liveliness and like security, et cetera. There's this triangle. And this kind of gets at this idea where there's this bet at liveliness a bit better, where we can get to also consensus a lot faster, right? But it was also the bet that there is some interesting things that you can do with that, kind of piggybacking off of Cosmos SDK. And we actually have another team called Union, which is essentially working on IBC now. So there's an interesting aspect of being able to kind of merge the worlds of ETH, like the EVM execution side, as well as Cosmos. And I think this is what the bigger bet, otherwise we would just become another EVM chain from that perspective, not to say that's the whole selling point, but because POL or proof of liquidity is the main selling point behind Bearer Chain.
Right.
This is an interesting bet that the team met.
So probably you sort of talked about Bearer Chain being a POL chain, they will move into that in a tick because we got questions. so in terms of IBC, then with Comet BFT, I believe the plan is to not really ever use IBC, right? Or are you guys considering connecting in on that side of things, or is that not really an option now with the execution layer being EVM?
So Union. I can't speak to Union in terms of them, but the whole goal is that they were actually actively working on this. So it actually plugs more on the consensus side to be able to see what it looks like in terms of bridging those transactions. I probably can't go into detail in terms of how it's going to work specifically, because I know I'm not a protocol engineer like Dev is, and I probably know it more at a high level, but that is the goal, is that there is going to be a bet at least on being able to provide IBC potentially in the future.
Is this the same Union that is just the Cosmos Union with Connor and those guys over there? Is that the Union you're talking about?
Union.build, essentially. Like if you go to their website, they're essentially working on this. And I'll post a link here if that works. But they're the team that's going to be working on this specifically.
Yeah, that's the same Union that I'm talking about. They've got their testnet up at the moment as well.
Yep.
I believe, well, you'd be in that testnet too, Cert, and probably Schulte too. But back on Lavender's in the comments, taxes and movie reviews. So that's usually where we end up, Manny. We end up sort of getting sidetracked and talking about tax, but resisting the urge today. So proof of liquidity. New concept for everyone involved, and you know, it can be quite a lot of misunderstandings with it, and you know, especially validators trying to wrap their head around it. It's completely different paradigm to what we're used to, obviously, and sort of, you know, the whole economics of the chain sort of changes with this mechanism. And so I was wondering, did you want to give us a brief rundown for me to then be able to probe you with questions on that? Or did you want me to just start asking you questions about it?
I'll try my best. If you, whatever questions you guys have, I'll try to do. The only thing I probably will preface, and I was just going to say this, is that the tokenomics are probably not finalized. So whatever I'm telling you right now, and I'm sure you guys have already seen some of the contracts, or even for that matter, how like the rewards come through the blocks. Those are probably they're changing at one point, and they're subject to change or whatnot in terms of up until mainnet. So,
so for those who are new to Bearchain and listening to this, so proof of liquidity is a mechanism whereby protocols, and you know, I'm going to butcher this, Matty.
Let's hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm trying to like picture it all in my mind while I'm talking about it. I should have written down a bloody speech. So, so basically we have, validators still have emissions based on how much stake they have. So emissions of BGT, and how that BGT gets to stakers is
what's BGT?
It's just the native token BGT.
So it's the it's what the governance token of the Bearer chain.
Manny, that's
yes. Yes. So yes and no for some things. So BGT.
No, five words into it.
Yeah. So BGT, Bearer chain governance token. It is a soulbound ERC-20 token. Essentially, so you can't transfer it. You can burn it for Bearer, which is our native gas token. And it is the essentially the token that's given for block rewards for validators. It's also used for essentially delegators or essentially users who have that BGT to be able to delegate to validators to essentially increase their reward bait in that sense. So as they delegate them to validators, they increase their chances of being able to get those rewards essentially per block. There so is another token
tied to, it's tied to a single account, and you can only burn. So what when you say, I might have misheard something there. So when you burn it, that allows you to exchange it for something else that you can then sell or trade or is liquid in some way?
Correct, yeah. And that is the native gas token. So technically what happens is that every block there is new BGT that's minted for the rewards. At that same time, there is Bearer that's also minted, but it's held in a sort of like a vault in that sense where it's kept one-to-one. So whatever BGT is minted, there's also Bearer that's minted on its behalf as well. So that it's there that anytime that somebody does decide, or if they do decide to be able to burn it, you know, there is something for it to be able to make it liquid in that perspective. But you might be asking like, you know, like, okay, well, why not just give me the gas token then? Like, what's the whole point of BGT, right? Well, the goal of BGT is really influence, right? If you think about it. So the way that that it works is that you, as I mentioned before, users get to delegate to validators to be able to increase their weight. So they're essentially kind of influencing the network and saying, hey, we trust these particular validators, right? And the way that they typically get that is through reward vaults. And some implementation of a reward vaults are DEX essentially, which is called BEX. So we have like whitelisted pools or another specific pools. There are reward vaults where if you LP into those pools, like Honey USDC, like not Honey USDC, but Honey Bearer for that matter. And Honey is actually our stable coin, which is our third token. You essentially will get a receipt token, which you get to stake into this reward token, the reward vault, sort of like a tokenized vault. You have shares, and validators actually, when they propose a block, they actually have to decide which reward vaults that they're actually distributing some of their BGT to. So basically every block that's proposed, there's new BGT that's introduced. Every validator has it's called a Bearer Chef, essentially a distribution list where they actually distribute to specific vaults. Those vaults essentially that are people that are qualified or people that stake those receipt tokens. And those were we have a lending protocol as well. So if you borrow from our lending protocol, you're eligible to be able to receive that BGT as well. And we have our perpetuals as well, which is called BURPS. So if you actually contribute to the Honey Vault, you get a receipt token, which you get to stake, and that makes you eligible for BGT as well. So validators can actually distribute.
What's the use case? Perhaps I was just dropped on my head as a baby. What's the situation? What's the reason why if there's a pegging of, you know, there's always interest when there's a pegging, isn't there? But if there's a pegging of one-to-one between the governance token and the liquid token, what's the rationale for ever actually then needing the governance token to be separate from the liquid token, given the supply should in theory be the same? And in order to actually to change that pegging is effectively going to cause like a devaluation and like a kind of change in the economics of the whole chain. So and bear in mind a constriction of the money supply that actually you could also achieve the same thing by changing inflation or having dynamic inflation in some way, like the control of the money supply. If that is something that's important, it can be done for another reason. So you know, you could just lock the other tokens. So is it purely just because it effectively gives you it means you don't need liquid staked assets because the two tokens are separate? But you know, do you get, I mean, my math is fuzzy, right? It's not my strong point, but you obviously have the larger pool of liquid tokens hypothetically, but given that as I understand it, they're already kind of locked up and held in trust, it's not like users are getting the benefit of like liquid staking derivatives or something like that. It's more that they just don't, you know, they have an extra layer of indirection, which I don't really fully understand.
Yeah. So we get this a lot in terms of kind of understanding, because most people's like perception is really to go back to like proof of stake, right? You know, you have your gas tokens, etc. It's, you know, I'm staking with it. I'm essentially getting my rewards in it. Everything is pretty, you know, straightforward in that sense. And we've basically bifurcated that, right? You have your governance tokens and your bearer token, right? The whole reason behind this was, and I recommend, there's a blog post from us called the Fat Bearer Thesis or whatnot. There's this idea of, it's called the original thesis was on the protocol thesis, and the other was the original one for web is actually the app thesis. So the app thesis is really applications or mega apps essentially kind of control the liquidity in terms of regular web 2 or web in general. If you think about it, like mega apps, like, I don't know, Uber, depending on what country, whatnot, a mega app or WeChat, whatnot, might be a mega app that kind of controls most of the actual revenue or liquidity in that sense. On blockchain, it's a little bit more one-sided in terms of protocols. So if you think about it, like there's a lot of locked TVL in terms of a chain, right? But some of the apps, they never see any of that money. Like they're basically trying to get at crumbs, if you can think about it. And not to say that those crumbs aren't big, you know, but at the same time, it's sort of like there seems to be like this weird imbalance that, you know, the protocol has like a ton of money, and like the dApps that are building in it, which are essentially bringing all the users to this chain as well, they're not like, there's no benefit from them apart from the actual use.
Well, it's because they don't charge money for their service up front. Yeah. So the problem that has been described with the kind of Web2 mega apps is that primarily, some of them do, actually Uber would be an example, although I know they have issues with profitability. They don't charge, you know, the upfront fee that necessarily, and actually to be fair, some delivery services, a prime example, like the deliveries of this world, right? They actually don't charge enough to cover their own costs and they lose money, right? So that's a similar problem, I suppose, where, you know, they have users, they accumulate a large amount of power and network effects, but don't actually make money. And part of the reason that they, one of the many hypotheses for what is going on here is actually that they are landowners, right? And their economic model would be conceptually the same as a walled garden, you know, like feudal landowning or something like that. Is like, oh, if you kind of look at different economic models, it's one of them you can apply to it, right? And you see this with very highly developed marketplaces in the space, like, you know, something like I think Amazon's like the easiest one, where they just go like, no, we own this, this is our land, we're going to essentially extract rent in one way or another. And a lot of the really large incumbents do this by selling your data, right? That's the actual rent you pay. And so the issue that you have, you know, with a lot of these dApps that are not charging money is that they're obviously never going to make money, right? Because they are in a landowning paradigm, because that's what crypto is, right? It's an oligarchy with landowning, and the blockchain substrate underneath own the land, right? So this is why I stopped developing dApps, incidentally. It's because there's no point developing dApps, because you can only ever make crumbs, because 1,000 years of economic history says that if you are a farmer tilling the land, you are only ever going to make money for the feudal landowner. So my question would be, in the context of a blockchain that is a platform blockchain, like, you know, the tokenomics can be very, very clever, but what can you actually do to ensure that, you know, short of telling people, hey, are you charging up front for what you're doing? what can you do to incentivize the actual splitting of kind of profits and revenues with the people that are building the projects? And I know, obviously, like dev grants and all sorts of things, you know, that's an option. Is there some other way?
So funny thing is that our one of our founders, Smokey, is actually very anti-grant. How explicit can we get on this podcast?
Yeah, as much as you want, mate.
Noel's Australian, like.
Yeah, there you go. It's like drinking water, basically. So he basically thinks of it as a form of prostitution in terms of grants. If you think about it, you're forcing somebody to do something that they might not have really cared about in the first place, and they're just going to be there to be able to get the money and probably leave from that. So there's not really in line is incentive for them to be able to kind of stick around. Right. I'll let him talk about that. And I'm sure his tweet in terms of being able to kind of work on that or go in depth on that part.
I believe we have very strong like alignment on that, Manny. There's plenty of rants I've gone on here previously about grants for applications that just don't make any fucking sense, but continue.
Don't get me started on like how there's not enough that's going towards open source in my opinion, like where it actually really needs to go. But to answer your question in terms of like the way that it essentially works, and this is where like proof of liquidity or POL kind of like flips its head. And this is, again, I'll reference our article on the Fat Bear thesis or whatnot. And Noah, one of our technical writers, is great in terms of this. And is sometimes this stuff is like over my head, honestly. Is really the idea that the way to really incentivize dApps to be able to build on chain is to let them know that they are actually going to be part of the chain in terms of being able to be more invested. And the way that we see that is that they actually would be able to get a portion of that TVL that kind of comes to the chain, right? Because they get to influence validators in terms of delegating, right? Every project can apply through a governance proposal, essentially. And we're seeing multiple ones that are going to be coming out to be able to create reward vaults. For them, that essentially is the way for validators to kind of distribute some of those governance tokens, which they could potentially later on become liquid. But the idea is that they would influence validators, and validators also get to influence in terms of being able to decide which projects they want to actually direct some of their emissions to, right? So there's this sort of flywheel, you can kind of say, that exists between and this symbiotic like relationship between like protocols and validators. And this is the thing that it requires a bit more activity, because validators have to actually choose like, hey, where am I distributing some of these emissions to? I can't just like, hey, I'm going to give you a yield and that's about it. I'm not really going to incentivize the ecosystem anymore. Like, I don't see any validators are making deals with, you know, like Uniswap, or for that matter, another, basically Uniswap, if they wanted to, they could just become a validator too and then be able to kind of start their own shop, right? There's nothing that's incentivizing them. That would be the only way that they would be able to kind of align themselves, right, in terms of an ecosystem. Otherwise, you get the same scenario which we're having right here, whereas a lot of validators are going to different chains, right? And it's there's no incentive for dApp provider or dApp builders essentially going to different chains and being able to say like, well, I'm just going to deploy to Polygon and then now I'm going to deploy to, you know, to Optimism or to other solutions. Like there's nothing for me to keep me here in terms of an actual chain. And if the way that I think of it is more like we're building out our dApps or app store in that sense. And this is kind of like the IP that goes behind Bearchain, because how do you keep dApps or how do you incentivize them to stick around is really to be able to say, hey, you need to be more, you know, invested in that. And the way that we've done that is really through governance tokens, right? Which again, you can make liquid, but it's an interesting way for them to also, I've seen different models where they can incentivize their existing user base, like example, like gaming where, hey, if you buy X amount of gems on my platform, I'll actually give you a receipt token, which will give you access to a reward vault, which you can kind of get yields from and actually influence in the network. So they have a win-win scenario in that aspect, or even projects where like, hey, I'm going to offer a bribe or what we call incentives to validators to be able to give certain tokens of my project as potentially as an investment. And all I need asking is you direct some sort of those rewards in terms of BGT to my reward vault. And this is an interesting way for them to kind of jumpstart also their businesses as well in terms of different apps. So just, it's really aligning validators and protocols a bit more and making it so that, you know, there are interesting things that are built on top of that ecosystem because they're more invested. And hopefully that plays into it. And I definitely recommend like checking out our docs because it has all these tons of graphics that I made in terms of kind of visualizing this a little bit better too.
The whole bribery side of things is very interesting. And I started talking to yourself and like other applications the other day about these bribes, and it all came along because an app came to me and they're like, okay, so we're looking at what mainnet looks like. And, you know, we want to get involved with some validators. We see you're like, you know, up there on the thing. So we want to talk to you. And so what kind of bribe do you, are you looking at for to direct some BGT to us? And I'm like, I do want a new Lambo.
Yeah.
But so I mean, I called you because I had no fucking idea what to like what kind of things I should be asking for. But then you obviously sort of what you just said, then you explained that, you know, the bribes is more of the incentives that they provide to for, you know, us to then want to go and direct some BGT to them so that we can then get some of whatever that incentive is in our wallet. But also, you know, off chain bribes aren't off the table either, welcome. Right? Like, you know, which kind of like, you know, it is, that's kind of a situation where, you know, do you guys think about how decentralization plays into this, or you're not interested in the decentralization theater? Because a lot of this seems to be making deals and stuff, whether on-chain and off-chain, handshakes, that type of stuff, people talking to people, which is not really traditionally the scope of crypto, right? Like usually people want to be as far apart from people as possible for the whole theater of decentralization. So yeah, I'm saying this thought bubble.
As somebody who's literally just written a paper that, for academics to say, hey, by the way, you do realize that everybody in these ecosystems talks to each other, and you do realize that they're all informally colluding because it's the only way these networks can survive. That surprises people, right? But it's kind of obvious when you only have 100 nodes. And for a lot of reasons, including regulatory reasons, it's actually quite a good idea that that notion persists, right? But then this is kind of saying the quiet bit out loud to some extent. Although I suppose to pick up on Null's point, you know, and something we've talked about in this podcast a lot is like, you know, what is, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, what you said, decentralization theater, what is decentralization? And there's, I wish I could pull it out of my massively rubbish memory at this point, but there's a whole bunch of networks theory apparently going back to like way pre all of this stuff, you know, probably when people were doing network switches or something like very actually clever and useful compared to what all of us degens are doing. That had a whole bunch of stuff about like upper bounds of nodes in a reliable network, and like the fact that all kind of validator stuff starts to fall apart around 100, 175, 200. I mean, obviously, there's a whole bunch of stuff in social network theories, like for humans, like apes together strong, whatever, man, about how we fall apart over 150 people, 150, 200, 250. We can't function much beyond there. But there's some stuff about how like it might, it's, there's an upper bound of peer-to-peer networks as well. There's a really interesting case study about the Tor ecosystem, which I won't get into because that's a whole rabbit hole. But obviously that's like kind of unincentivized, and there's a, like a network of nodes and exit nodes and what they called in Tor, the ones in the middle, relay nodes, middleware nodes.
So hang on, before you continue on that,
I'm out, man.
Are you saying that the amount of validators that can exist in a network is directly related to Dunbar's number?
I mean, fuck, that could. I hadn't actually even considered it, but maybe.
Yeah, it's like the digital world and the social world are so alike.
Well, no, because in Tor nodes, it's an order of magnitude bigger. It's like between 2,000 and 7,000, depending on period of time. But getting above that, there's some theory that's gone into how you can expand that even further, and there's not a lot of agreement. And it's a really, really good. So the reason it's relevant is that the running of the Tor network is a really, really good example of a community where it's big enough that people run nodes for a whole variety of reasons, in a whole variety of jurisdictions, in a whole variety of legal situations, in a low trust environment. Often semi-anonymously, it has some comparison to the sort of stuff we do, except it's done fully without expectation of profit. And there is some theory behind this, like where people have studied it, that says that if you actually introduced economic, like hard money incentives into that, it would actually, the number of provided nodes would go down. But unfortunately, I don't have the citation to mind. It was just a discussion that somebody who has been in the Tor ecosystem since like the start was telling me this, like, oh, yes, there's a bunch of stuff. And I was like, I need to go read about that because that sounds fascinating. But I don't have the exact citation to hand. But incentives, man.
So the theory is that if you introduce some form of incentives, basically decentralization suffers to some extent.
Yes, there's two bits. One is that decentralization seems to have an upper bound in ecosystems where it's more organically come up, right? In human civilization, we see that it has an upper bound based on communication, capacity of individual nodes in the network, Dunbar's number. And in more meshy networks, it seems that there are also upper bounds. And then, yes, additionally, the question is, and the argument that's being had is, does adding incentives that are the wrong incentive actually harm a network that is functioning without incentives? And indeed, would these kind of networks function without incentives? There's a whole actual argument that says you can run a payment network without incentives, which that's a whole other thing. I think it might be true, incidentally, but it requires a whole bunch of things that we don't currently have, like very light clients, blah, 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 blah.
So then is Ethereum then the outlier in that thesis then?
I think Ethereum is a technological freak for sure. Like it's like, you know, like any piece of technology where it's like the exception rather than the rule. I think if you assume every blockchain is going to be like Ethereum, or if you assume Ethereum is like, you know, whatever, man, like... is if you assume Ethereum is a template from where we're going, you know, it's an interesting technological experiment that got out of hand and is now being grandfathered into the traditional economic system by trad boomer finance bros who see that it's a way of playing around with a bunch of stuff without the same regulatory controls they would have for like brushing their fucking teeth in the morning. Like they can't move from one part of the office to another part of the office without, you know, filing a log form saying that this nominally independent part of the building, which is one subsidiary, is firewalled from this part, but the toilets in that part of the building and my desk is over here. So I'm actually not even fully joking about this. There are some companies that have that kind of paperwork. Luckily, I've never worked for one, but, you know.
Or governments.
These things happen, right? You know, regulations. But then these same organizations can just be like, hey, whoa, wait, we can just mint a shitcoin?
Yeah. And depending on regulation. depending where you are in the world.
Yeah, sure. Well, in this country, the answer is if you've got good enough lawyers, what's going to happen to you? Like, it's boys will be boys as long as you don't advertise it. And if you're going to advertise it, you apply to the Financial Conduct Authority and get regulated. And if you're already regulated by the FCA, then you're already regulated by the FCA. I mean, it's just about risk tolerance at that point, right? So I don't know. But it's a digression. It's not really related to protocol and liquidity, is it?
It definitely went off on a solid fucking tangent.
I'm going to be creating YouTube snippets on this on just the number of tangents that are for this podcast. 100%.
Yeah, we don't really have a line that we walk here. We sort of, it's like, you know, when they get you out of the car when you're hammered drunk and you have to do the test. This is the test.
Totally happens to me every day. That's right. Drunk driving all the time.
Do you even own a car, Manny? You live in the city, right?
I do, but not in this country. I own a car in Turkey, basically. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess
that sounds so sketchy. Like, I own a mule van in like Turkey or something.
It's like, yeah, I bought a car in Turkey. You know, it's good. It's cheap on Facebook Marketplace. So that's what I've got.
I don't like light that one on fire and walk away. I had to get out of that one, but yeah, I haven't had one.
For reference, I've lived in Turkey for a number of years too, and my wife is Turkish, and so that's the reason why we own a car in Turkey.
So does that mean, like, do you have a house in Turkey still, or are you just, you know, is it? I imagine that there's this, you know, nicely set up house with the Land Cruiser in the driveway, just waiting for you to come back to it one day, you know. Sort of just comes out every morning and looks down the street and up the street and is like, goes back in, just waiting.
We still have a place in Turkey. My wife and I go back and forth between Canada and Turkey, in specifically a place called Antalya. That's where we have our place, which is really, really nice.
I went on holiday there a few times when I was a kid. It's very nice.
There's a lot of people from the UK that goes there. Right now in my area, there's probably more Russians and Ukrainians because of the war, though. But there is a lot of people that come down from the UK. But yeah, as far as it goes, like we go half the year here, half the year there, whatnot. Mostly for winter because it's nicer there, and it makes it a little easier also to go to other European countries too. So,
The plan is to go back there permanently, relatively soon.
Okay, so we're gonna get into like the tax conversation now.
Look, man, I mean, dancing around it the whole time here. We need to talk about tax at some point. So it's totally tax time.
So Turkey is an interesting country because there is no tax on crypto. It doesn't consider it a store of value in that sense. It's illegal to accept it as a business to be able to, hey, like, I'm gonna accept this as a currency, etc. But there's a weird gray area where you can accept crypto and you don't have to claim it because it's not considered money. So there's a lot of centralized exchanges that exist there. So you think of Bybit, OKX, Binance, all of them kind of are there in terms of the market. And there is this weird stat. I don't know where it is, so I don't know if it's completely accurate, but it said half the population of Turkey holds crypto, which is like 40 million people, if you think about it. And that's partly because of the inflation that they're dealing with, right? Yes. But yeah, as far as it goes, I'm probably going to be moving. I'm going to be becoming a Turkish citizen and hopefully take advantage of those taxes in terms of not paying tax on crypto in Turkey, basically.
And there's no limit to that number. That could be 100% of your income. So therefore you pay no tax on anything.
Agree. Yeah. And the interesting thing is the other interesting thing, and I don't know how it is for other countries or how it is in the UK, like in Canada and in the US, you have to file your taxes every year or whatnot. Mm-hmm. In Turkey, if you don't make any money, you just don't file your taxes. It's as simple as that. So there's like less paperwork involved as all.
And crypto profits would be classed as not making any money.
Exactly. Like, it's not money. It's fictional, right?
That's so crazy.
You're never going to file a tax return again. What about on the cash side of things? Like, so obviously you've got your crypto, but, you know, it goes in and out of a, a centralized exchange. So when you like cash out money into, real Turkish lira, is that, do you have to keep some sort of cash accounting? Do they account that as like a cash flow, profits, income, nothing like that? They're like, that's funny money.
Not financial advice. I should preface this all, but
we don't have any financial advice here. We talk about it all the time, but it's definitely not advice.
There is a couple accountants that I deal with in terms of what that looks like. But as far as it goes, from my understanding, and I could be completely wrong in terms of this exact term, but it'd be the akin to like a friend giving you money. So like you wouldn't pay taxes on a friend giving you money back in that sense or putting in your account. And
I can tell you that over here, if a friend gives you money, you're probably paying tax on it if it's a fair quant.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they've cracked down even on the US with like, what's that cash app that everybody like Venmo, whatnot as well.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's a little bit, that's where I say it's like Turkey is a little bit weird in that sense. Like it's a very gray area for some of these things. So, to some extent, like you would cash it out into fiat and then you could store it in, with a local bank in terms of, they'll have US accounts as well. But yeah, it's legal in the sense that I know quite a few people that they're doing as well, or they just cash out when they need to. And if they want to run them through businesses, then that's when they'll probably have to pay taxes on it. But as an individual, they shouldn't have to.
So over in Turkey, like they've got quite a severe like inflation problem at the moment, right? So you mentioned US dollars. So are a lot of banks over there offering US dollar bank accounts as an alternative currency to the lira, given that the situation of it? I know that they, I'm sorry, this is getting a bit off on a tangent, but I'm sure that the Turkish government were giving incentives for people to save their money and not spend it in lira, right? Like they were inflation plus, as whatever the inflation is, we'll give you that plus another incentive, which will just print to keep your money in the bank.
It was crazy. Like, so we in Turkey, it's called Mevduat. And basically what it is at one point, when we had money in it too as well, it was somewhere of like 40 or 50% APY, which was crazy. And it wasn't like locked. You could like withdraw it every month. You just had to keep it a minimum of like 30 days. But if you kept it in the local currency, you can still get some of the rates really, really high right now in terms of getting returns. At one point we had enough money in it that it was paying for our rent because of some rent like restrictions in terms of, for things. But, yeah, it's crazy. But a lot of people they have a mistrust in terms of how, financially Turkey has been handling things, and they've basically just been hedging their bet and buying USDC or, USDT mostly primarily, to kind of have US dollars or have access to it. Because one of the issues is that you can have it with a bank that's local, but they're going to charge you crazy amount of fees. They might have more restrictions. And actually Turkey actually made it, if you're familiar with a service called like Wise or some of these proxies that do exchanges like really, really cheap, they've had to shut down for Turkey because one of the requirements is that they had to have a physical presence in Turkey. And a lot of companies were like, no, we're not going to do that. Right. So they ended up saying, okay, well then you don't meet the restrictions. So we're going to have to shut you down. So you don't have a means to be able to do it. So everybody has to go through traditional banking to be able to kind of have a US account. And you'd basically have the whole SWIFT thing, and the fees to be able to kind of transfer to another country are still quite high. So crypto is like the best way for them to leverage that. Right.
So have you had a meeting with the Turkish government yet and floated, just Bera as a alternative currency?
Yeah. I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, we have our stable coin called Honey. So I'd be kind of curious. Obviously, Turkey is like a weird place, man. Like I've like heard stories of people like selling their houses and like betting all in on crypto and like losing it all too. But also like the ecosystem of them just needing it. Like I tweeted this out the other day where somebody was going to buy a car, but they were trying to get a loan for a car, and the interest rate, and this was the discounted rate because they were a business, was 50% on a car loan. And they were like, this is ridiculous. So what they ended up doing was they're like, hey, I actually have some crypto. I'm just going to take a loan on Aave. They did that and they bought their car because the interest rate was like 10 times cheaper, basically. So it's funny that there's like this missing, like there's this gap of opportunity also for blockchains. And I have this like weird hypothesis that that validators at one point in emerging markets, at least, have an opportunity to become banks, because I think it's an interesting opportunity, because if you think about it, you're effectively printing money, right? And that money probably is not going to be that great in terms of like, you know, Western countries or whatnot, but that money is still, in terms of loans, in terms of arbitrage, in terms of like you offering it for a, you know, an emerging market, it's an interesting opportunity for you to kind of say, hey, well, I can become a financial institution, right? And be able to offer these services that would be competing to traditional banking services.
Right. Yeah.
But it's not
money and it's not a bank, is it? Like, because I could attack it via finality. So I could get 33.4% of a blockchain to say just blacklist any TX coming through from that validator. I could do, because it's fundamentally still a low trust environment, right? So the opportunities for this stuff in the current state of where we are with low trust systems, right, which is that they're sort of low trust, but they're in a trusted enough situation that's actually quite easy to engineer system level collusion, is that you are attackable constantly at a systemic level and an individual level, which is not, it's not possible on Ethereum because of economic finality, right? The TVL is too high. Chain can't sustain it. Although people said that about it pre the DAO hack, and that was still worth a few quid back then, as I recall. And you know, still reverted the ledger, still changed history. Could that happen again? Probably not. Probably not on Ethereum. Could it happen on most other chains? Yeah, probably.
I don't think it's perfect. Like,
yeah, for sure. Like, I think it's just that as a validator business who would like to not get regulated, I think it's a dangerous line of argument that I very strongly like to point out to regulators in the UK that our business model is in an emerging market where the assets can be lost by acts of God, by token governance, by random degens on the internet designed to delete it all. And we should not be regulated like a bank, and we should not be treated like a bank. And in fact, you know, there's a whole discussion of what cryptocurrencies are, but they sure aren't money. So that's another thing. But their adjacency to money is very strongly related to the economic stability of the jurisdiction in which you're in, I suppose, which is the point there for the emerging market question, I suppose. The argument with the emerging market question becomes like, well, okay, are you better off just supplying them with a low trust infrastructure for buying US dollars or euros or whatever, something that's central banked, but with a similar infrastructure that is doesn't need centralized trust in their country's economic policy, right? And you can actually obviously engineer that system with the same principles as a cryptocurrency, whereby you would have individual validators taking some portion of a fees, whatever, you know, like if something has inherent value, or not inherent value, but consistent value, you can build a business case around it. And given what, you know, you're saying Swift fees, it doesn't take much to undercut Swift and still make a sizable profit on Forex. Let's be honest, right? I mean, hey, like this is, if it wasn't like so insanely regulated, this is one of those markets, you know, no usurper, we should put our heads together and just knock this one on the head. We should just solve Forex at some point and make a few bob. We can make a few quid on that, I reckon. What do you guys reckon? You in? We got three nodes right here.
Well, I mean, like, you know, I just know.
Do you know, I was talking to an Aussie bloke the other day who was telling me about how on it you lot are about, you know, central bank crypto and stuff. And you've been talking about it for ages. And they were like, yeah, we're pretty good at Australia. And I was like, I have an Australian colleague who absolutely loves his government's tax position on how crypto works, and would really love them to introduce a central bank digital currency that ideally makes him lots of money. Please tell me.
I don't I don't think there's a scenario in which the central bank's digital currency could ever make me money, but it will certainly make it a lot easier for the country to control the money supply. But in terms of like, are we onto it or not? So I know that ANZ has like people dedicated to researching this, and they are definitely talking about centralized digital currencies for the banks. I don't know if the government is on board with that.
I heard that there's something around wholesale, I think that must be what you're describing, right? Where it's between the banks for like clearing and stuff, because they're currently, you know, they have a huge amount of fees and infrastructure for just their intrabank clearing.
So a little while, like you know, maybe 10 years ago, the big banks here in Australia, there's only four of them. There's ANZ, Commonwealth, NAB, and another one. They're like what they call the big four here. I can't remember. What is the other one? I don't know. Oh, Westpac. So
Slayer.
They all sort of got together, you know, a decade ago, and they built a new faster settlement backend for our banks. So it's called OSCO, and it's available to all the banks, so far as I know. And, you know, we can settle a transaction here in like seconds. So if I send my mum $20 while she's at the supermarket to pick me up a bottle of milk, you know, I can get on my little app and I can send that and it's there. Whether it's $20 or $2 million, as long as you've got the clearance to send that through your bank, it's there. And then it's cleared, it's finalized, you can do what you want. So they developed that and implemented that in the background. And I think I was reading something the other day, and this could be total bullshit, but I'm sure I was reading something where those guys over at bloody who's got that shit coin that keeps going to court, and they got their cross border settlement stuff. Who are those guys? Ripple? I think Ripple have something to do with the back end of that. Yeah. Well, XRP is like, you know, different to Ripple the company, but Ripple the company have some other settlement products that they've been working on for a fair while now, and I think they may have something to do with that back end process. I'm not sure if there's actually like any cryptography that backs it, or if it's just a general ledger that everyone writes to with you know, a permissioned ledger or something.
They sponsor a lot of academic conferences that are in Switzerland. That's all I really know about. The Ripple behind the scenes, they obviously have a particular market they're going for.
Fun fact, Brad Garlinghouse was the richest man in the world at one point, when there was a pump on XRP in like 2017 or 18 or something like that. The last, you know, maybe 2021, the last pump, when I think XRP was like
so long ago. I don't even remember.
Yeah.
I was a young man then.
So I think XRP was like $3.50 or $4 or something, Australian. I don't know what it was, US, but Ripple, the company at the time, owned like 60 billion of them, which was 60% of the supply. Cause I think there's 100 billion or something of that supply. And, you know, various, creators, owned some. The Ripple company owned 60 billion. And obviously the CEO, Brad Garlinghouse, owns a lot of that company. And then, so by proxy, ended up being, for a couple of days, the richest dude in the world. Fun fact.
Didn't know that. Fair enough.
Yeah, it was definitely only a couple of days. I think you know, maybe I was the richest guy in the world at one point, with some shit coin for 30 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? What was it? Juno peaked at when that guy accidentally shorted it and they fucked up a liquidity pool, tried to front run a liquidity pool. Was it $3,000?
Oh, god damn.
Yeah. Do you remember like right at the start of Juno, somebody tried to exchange like thousands and thousands of dollars, like 9,000 euros or something worth of Atom for Juno, and got like
I think I do remember that.
Is it, yeah, if you could trade one Juno for 9,000 euros, then we'd have all been the richest people on the planet. But hey,
I've been rich in many shit coins. Remember Netta? I was rich in Netta for 30 seconds too. That was all right. I was rich in Raw for 30 seconds. I was rich in that other shit coin for 30 seconds on Juno. I was rich a couple of times on Juno, but unfortunately, the dumb side of my brain said keep it all.
Yeah. What's the most amount of money that any of you guys have lost, out of curiosity?
I think the last shitcoin pump in 2020, when it all fell apart, we had a significant amount of shitcoin, like over $1 million that was locked up in various ways that we lost most of. I'd say basically all of when that market came crashing down. So
yeah, if you add like all of the stuff that was, so there was like this big period of time where validators got incentives like early in networks from like lock tokens that didn't unlock for like, you know, something, some case like 6 years or whatever, or whatever it might be. So it wasn't like you really, you legally didn't even have access to them. I should really strongly specify, for tax and legal reasons, that we really have no access to
these assets.
You know? Yeah. But you know, it's like, it's one thing to be like, oh, hypothetically in 6 years, if we had access to these, this would be worth $1 million. Right. And then like now that's like worth like $2,000 or something. And you're like, but of course what happens is like at the point where you look at it and you're like, God, that's a hypothetical amount of money in like 6 years time, where that's like, you know, $200,000 or something. What's actually happening is the founders of that project are at that very moment selling everything. And that is exactly why you will never recoup in 6 years time. And you know, sooner or later you have that conversation with your lovely accountants where you say, I think it's time for us to write this down. Let's put that in as functionally illiquid.
but that's more like lost opportunity, right? Like as opposed to like you putting capital in, right? Like what would be like the most amount of money that you've lost by putting in capital? Curiosity.
Probably it'd be in the
everybody's over, like, I don't put money into this.
that's not true. Cause if you say you pull your, you know, we keep profits in USDC, right? So that's, I would say that's then ours, right? That's money that we can then put back in. And we've bought coins for various reasons. It might be just to buy a stake to stay in a chain in the early days or something, just to keep in there or something like that. We've definitely lost, you know, six figures doing that.
But maybe Terra, right? Terra would be the, I mean, that was an event that, you know, people had stables and that was, I think that's not
usually, yeah, a lot of,
that's not an investment loss, but that's a true loss. That's not like, that was over the course of 30 minutes, not watching Juno drop over the course of four months or whatever it was, right?
Yeah. 2 years.
Yeah. 2 years. It's still going. Yeah. Unrealized gains is difficult to be able to quantify, but like stuff like that, like losing tokens in Terra or USDT.
Well, I mean, I can say we paid tax on like, We pay tax. I
just love every comment. It's like, we pay taxes. Everything is kosher here.
We're not a bank. We do pay taxes.
Because of the way taxes work, you pay it on the unrealized. If you stake, that's a taxable event, right? So if you make money off a protocol, you make money from rewards, and you withdraw those, you claim those rewards and then restake them, you create a taxable event and you immediately pay tax at the market value on that day of the token. So we, on various Cosmos chains, restaked pretty heavily in the last bull run, and we had to pay I think, you know, we had to pay tax on something like £200,000, I think, worth of hypothetical gains for tokens that are now probably cumulatively worth about 10 grand or something.
That's okay. So it works like that in Canada too. Like, it's weird. It's like, so for you, do you end up just writing that off? Like,
yeah, you eventually are going to have to unstake it and just sell it at market, realize the loss. And then it means if you're validating a chain in future and the token price radically inflates, you won't pay any capital gains tax on it as a business, because as a business you'll say, look, well, we're already running a net loss of like 100k or whatever it is on the balance sheet. I mean, it's a lot less than that, because it will be whatever 13% of whatever. So but it gives you, it means you can like not, you can pay a bit less tax, but obviously like you'd rather make the money and then pay the tax on the money you just made, rather than lose money and then get a tax rebate later on money that you still have to make a second time, because now you've just had to make money twice to cover the fact that you lost it the first time.
Casino style.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the industry. That's the industry. Like, it's crypto. Like, everybody has flubbed their taxes or done something inefficient, or like from a personal basis. Like, I got paid for some work to me personally, not to the company, because it just got sent straight to my wallet, which very not ideal. And you don't want to ever do that. If you work in the crypto space, always work through a company, always have stuff paid into company wallets, blah, blah, blah. But it was, you know, whatever. And I was like, ooh, this coin's a bit risky. So I converted it into another one, which was much more easy, like name recognition. And I was just like, well, just leave it in there to the end of the tax year and figure out what to do with it. And then the place I put it tanked. And so I had to pay the tax, like as an individual. So not even me as, you know, the company that I run. It's me as an individual. I had to pay the tax bill on the value of the token at the point where I was given it. And then by the time I sold it off, it was worth like, you know, a fraction. So you had to, like the tax bill I had, like by selling absolutely everything, I just about covered the tax bill that I had. And I was like, this is why I shouldn't trade anything or have gut feelings about anything, because I'm just going to be wrong. And after that, on the couple occasions where people have paid me directly for advice, help, or just a thank you or whatever, I've just sold it immediately. Just never look back. You just go boom. As a company, we do different things, but as an individual, yeah, no way. That's the only way you can be sure, right?
Is that the same in Australia though? Like, I'm just beginning to wonder if this is like a monarchy thing or whatnot.
So I didn't catch any of what the phrase said because I wasn't fucking listening. But what happens over here as an individual, if you get crypto somehow, then it's income. If you get an airdrop, it's income. If someone sends it to you, it's income. If the source is like not known, it's income. At the same time, if you have to calculate a cost base for everything. So if you sent me, I don't know, 10 bearer and that was worth $100, then I have to pay income tax on $100. And then I then have an asset of $100 of bearer, and my cost base is $100 for that $10 a bearer. And then if it becomes worth more, I'm liable for capital gains tax. If it becomes less, I'm liable for, I get a capital loss, which I can put against other capital gains. And that's about how it works. So everything you buy and sell, you have to have a cost base and a sell price, and then the difference is capital gains or losses. And it's a total fucking administration nightmare as an individual.
That's why you pay for bookkeeping, though, isn't it?
That's why you move to Turkey.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but you can do other things as a business. That's as an individual, as a business, there's other options. Which,
like,
is
just firing every accountant who disagrees with you until you eventually roll the dice and the accountant's like, I like the cut of your jib. Let's go with your strategy. And you're like, excellent.
My strategy is now canon. It's in the fucking website. ATO website. So my assumptions were correct. So I'm well within the bounds of what's acceptable.
Are you paying cap gains on just holding it or if you're staking it?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah. If you just held it
as an individual or a business?
As an individual.
As an individual, if I take
sitting in your wallet
of shitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's still, you can stake it. It's still yours. If you don't realize any of that, of the rewards, then it's not income yet. So it's only income when you realize it. And it's only a taxable event when you sell it.
So while you're holding it,
this is what I would love is if here it was the same thing.
While you're holding it, it's still a capital asset. So
it's a capital asset.
Whether it's staked or not, it's still a capital asset. You haven't disposed of it.
Right.
Yeah. So it's disposals that trigger a capital gains tax event.
Sure.
Yeah.
But just holding in a wallet is considered
staking as a disposal, which is super weird.
Yeah.
That's crazy. He's redefining, I think. Because if it wasn't for that, you'd just be like, oh, sweet, cool. This totally makes sense. Everything else about it makes sense because it's basically what Niall's just described. But yeah.
But I mean, say if you have I don't know, some staked Juno, right? And you're like, all right, I'm going to sell this now. And then you unstake it. At the same time, you trigger a income tax event because you get the pending rewards issued to you at the same time you unstake it, right? So you can't unstake it without triggering an income tax event. So you get that. And then, so now you have to calculate the cost base for that income, which is the same as the income. So now you have a capital asset plus you're releasing your other assets, which takes, I don't know, 28 days. So after 28 days, you take everything out of your account and then you send it to a centralized exchange, for example. So then you have a fee that you have to record, which has a cost base of something that you have to calculate, right? So that fee is a disposal. So you have to calculate the cost base of that disposal, and that's how much the fee is. And then it lands in your account at centralized.
But you're using a centralized exchange, right? Don't you just have Coinly?
Yeah, but it still has to. It's not, Coinly's not very good at calculating cost bases of things, by the way.
Well, sure, but it gives you the time. It gives you the time, the asset, it gives you everything you need to then hand it over to a bookkeeper and go, okay, cool. Just like go on this magical website called CoinGecko and find out the historical price on today.
What I'm getting to is that just to do one simple thing, unstake and sell, you trigger about fucking five or six different events, right? That are taxable. Yeah, yeah. Cool. And then you have to track all of that. So that's doing one thing. If you're like active in crypto, you're triggering hundreds a day and you have you have to track the cost base of everything. It's an absolute fucking nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean,
and like,
I had to write custom software to do this in the early days. Of
Cosmos, exactly. Because Coinly is,
and then Coinly's, I found that there's people
fucking
who
Juno, is it?
No, but then it doesn't matter because you just, what this it is does magical. Matter because there's magical people called bookkeepers, right? And what they do is they do administrative tasks related to accounting. If you just like give them the couple of extra tools that they need to do, like go to CoinGecko and here's a spreadsheet of whatever. And
you actually have to keep the spreadsheet. You had to write software to extract the data. Like,
I don't need that anymore. I don't use it. I haven't used it in a year. I just pay people to do it now.
Well, in any case, you're having to pay someone to do it, right? So that's more expense. You're missing the point. It's an administrative nightmare, whether you do it or pay someone else to do
it. It's no longer my nightmare, which is like the key essential point here. Like, I'm really trying to get across the point that like my administrative nightmare now, that period of my life is over.
What I want to understand, and maybe we can have Manny
but
Manny
back. Do you find like
– maybe we can have Manny back. Is what I do want to understand is how – I do want to understand the tax structure for bearer proof of liquidity when my validator node is diverting BGT back to five or six liquidity pools with bribe. Like, is there a model for that? How's that going to happen?
Yes, you go straight to jail. You go straight to jail. Do not pass go.
Actually, no, what you have to do is step one, move to Dubai, which everybody's essentially doing. And then you're good. You don't have to deal with any of that.
None of that stuff.
Or go to Turkey. I'm kind of curious. In relation to this or whatnot, mm-hmm. Because taxes have just been getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And I've talked to like a number of people that are also in crypto in North America or some Western countries or whatnot. I wanted to get your guys' impression because for you guys, are you getting the same where people are thinking like, hey, I'm moving because this is way too much or whatnot. Like, have you guys seen that sentiment as well?
I think tax is so fucking ingrained in Australians that they don't care.
Yeah.
Like, you do get your hardcore cryptos who are like, man, this tax, the government's robbing us every day, fucking blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't mind paying tax. This country would be fucked without tax because of all the roads and infrastructure that needs to be built. Like, you know, just to go to the next town, I'm driving 200Ks down the road. Could you imagine how fucked that road would be if there was no tax? That's... Obviously, the government's pretty bad at spending money.
We've all seen
that.
And
they do
right?
waste absolute shitloads of it. That's Mad Max would be like the that would be the upper echelon of roads around here if we didn't pay tax. Have you seen the fucking terrain that's out here? They turn that shit into roads. They dig it up, lay it out, turn it around. But, you know, infrastructure, sewer, water, how the fuck is anyone going to get this without paying tax? So let's pay your fucking tax, man.
Yeah, I mean, the only people I've ever encountered in the UK who are very like moved to a new place because of tax, because they're in crypto, very, very young men who have just decided that's a thing. And at least one person I met, they were like, yeah, I'm going to move to can't remember where it was. And then I think they might have got laid off like really shortly after that. And it was like, so you just like kind of moved because of your job, but now your job has ended. And now you just live in a place you don't fucking like. And you're probably going to have to move back because they're not going to extend your visa. Now you don't have the big balls crypto income. So, you know, what was the fucking point? You may as well just have stayed in the same place, paid your tax and played five-a-side football with your mates at the weekend and had a life, you know? I don't know. So it kind of depends where your center of gravity as a person is, doesn't it? And also, like Noel said, you know, I had a kid, you know, we have free healthcare here. Like you go through that process and you're just like, yep, it's what tax pays for. I got no problem with it. You know.
So also like, look at it like this, right? I'm sure Dubai is a really nice place. I've never been there, but I do know you have to be fucking rich to live there because a lot of the people, like people go there because they're rich, which makes
sense. And not gay, right? Dubai is like one of those places. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that, right?
I think it's getting by the day more and more westernized. Maybe they do. But in any case, it's a very expensive place to live, and it's only getting more expensive as more and more rich people move there. So you might be dodging the tax, but your cost of living is going up astronomically. And I can't sustain living in fucking Dubai. Like, you know, I'm not driving around in a Lambo. I'm not moving there just for tax. And Australia is a beautiful country to live. It's fucking enormous. There's hardly anyone that lives here. Great roads from all the tax that we pay. And like free healthcare, good schools, fucking beaches. Why would you want to go anywhere else? Fuck America. Freedom's here.
That is such an Australian reaction to it.
Nice.
It's like starts as taxes, ends with, and have you fucking seen the beaches? Like
beautiful white sandy beaches, man. We're fucking surrounded by them. You can go anywhere and just walk into a beach and die or surf, whichever one you want to do.
Well,
you can get eaten by a shark or drown or get on a.
Well, there's fucking jellyfish. There's jellyfish up in like the north.
Irukandji up north. Yeah, you can't go in the ocean up there.
I was like all stoked. I was like, saw this big old fucking beach. I was like, let's go, and then like wander towards it, and there's all these signs saying, if you touch the water, motherfucker, if you go near the water, a box jellyfish is going to jump out, rip your fucking heads clean off your shoulders. And you're like, cool, message plus, received, just, not going in the water.
Just being Australian practically makes you a warrior, because there is everything trying to kill you here, whether you're in the water, on the land, hiding in your bathtub, this stuff at all, it's just around the corner, death at every turn. The phrase just started laughing uncontrollably. But, you know, there's also tax helps out with that as well. They, you know, keep some of that crazy wildlife under control.
So it's funny because, like, I think the difference, well, maybe, I don't know about the UK specifically, but it's maybe because you trust your administration to actually
No. We've just had the worst government for the last 14 years that's happened since the war. Probably the worst government, although there have been some really bad other governments.
Every government is always worse than the previous one. They don't seem
this
to
was
get
pretty
better.
Special. Like,
and they also seem to get worse at spending money subsequently. Like, it's like they just get fiscally dumber as it goes along.